or field hospitals, and we have information that the work will start in 2 days.
Palestinian Health Minister May Al-Kayla said earlier that the West Bank is facing a third wave of the pandemic. The Palestinian government has imposed new restrictions, including the closure of schools and universities, but it seems that measures have failed to quell rising infections among the Palestinians.
Like, this situation is very difficult. It can be described as an unprecedented coronavirus cases spike. We were hoping not to open field hospitals, but to witness an end to this virus. After recommendations from Health Directorate and the Ministry of Health, there is an urgent need for a serious position from all the Palestinians. After 1 year, they should completely abide by the measures.
People of the West Bank demand the Palestinian Authority to import vaccines. However, the PA has managed to acquire only a few thousand doses of vaccines, not even enough for frontline health workers. As observers say, the gap between Israel and the Palestinians has illustrated the global inequity between rich and poor nations in terms of access to vaccines. UN officials and human rights groups have expressed concerns over the disparity, saying Israel is an occupying power that is responsible for the well-being of the Palestinians.
1 year on, the COVID-19 still rages on in the occupied West Bank, with hospitals filled up amid shortage of medical equipment. This has led the Palestinian Authority to adopt new measures, including strict lockdown, to cope with the new wave of the pandemic. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Refugee camp in the suburbs of New Delhi is gripped in utter panic and despair. After hundreds were rounded last week and detained in Jammu region of Indian-controlled Jammu and Kashmir for possible deportation, according to police and local administration there.
We have no idea of what will happen to us. We are living here peacefully. We will survive on just one meal a day, but we urge the Indian government not to deport us because the military there will kill us. We are thankful to have got shelter in India. At least we are alive.
Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India. Escaping genocide in their country. Estimates suggest some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living across different states of India. Anti-Rohingya sentiments have been rising in India since the emergence of the Hindu nationalist government of the Bharatiya Janata Party in 2014. The ruling party calls the Rohingya people illegal immigrants and a security threat. Many vicious anti-Rohingya campaigns in the Jammu region also called for their expulsion a few years ago, leaving the community in great distress. Fearing arrest and possible detention, many have gone into hiding, while others are in panic. Activists say it's unfair to detain or deport them, considering the situation in their country.
Already the refugees have started calling me up, and many have already sent me messages on the phone, apprehending danger to themselves and their community. We will take to both national and international campaigning to safeguard the security, dignity and safety of the Rohingya refugees as well as all other refugees in India.
Human Rights Watch and other rights groups have urged India to halt any deportation plan, saying conditions in Myanmar are not conducive. They say the Indian government should uphold its international law obligations and protect those in need of refuge within its borders. India has hosted refugees from many countries since decades, but adopted an aggressive approach towards Rohingya Muslims in particular. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
In a rarely seen demonstration of unity, the French Solidarity Movement with Palestine showed its support for Olivia Zimmer, one of the pillars of the BDS movement. Olivia will be judged next week for her participation in BDS actions. The official accusation, anti-Semitism, an insult towards a foreign state. BDS stands for Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Against Israel.
There is no legal base to condemn me, and therefore I hope that the judges will remain independent from the political powers. By the way, the French state accepts boycott actions against China, Corsica, or against Russia and Iran. They accept that Brigitte Bardot boycotts Canadian products because of mistreating seals. But if we boycott Israel, they say it's discrimination.
The French government is acting against an important resolution of the European Court of Human Rights. This court decided in June last year that BDS is a legal political movement and obliged the French state to pay 100,000 euros to falsely condemned BDS activists. However, the French Justice Minister, Éric Dupond-Moretti, gave instructions to prosecutors, magistrates and judges in France to condemn appeals to boycott Israeli products. Since 2005, Olivia Zemmour is one of the main organizers of the BDS campaign in France, with remarkable actions in supermarkets. These kind of actions were considered worldwide as keystones and have been copied in many other countries. Other type of actions were held in official institutions like the French Football Federation to protest against the silence of Europe when Israel jailed, injured or killed footballers in Gaza. A third type of actions were protests when delegations to Palestine were withheld by Air France under direct Israeli pressure.
BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions Campaign, it's very important for us as a Jewish organization to support Palestinian rights, to tell Israel that it must respect international law and that it can't get away with murder. It can't get away with just anything. And this fallacious accusation of anti-Semitism just doesn't hold water.
Today, Israel considers the BDS campaign as a real danger for its propaganda system. Therefore, it uses all kinds of pressure on Western states to criminalize it. But the Palestinian Solidarity Movement stands still and alert. As observers say, if the French government wanted to respect the recommendation of the European Court of Human Rights, it would simply cancel this trial against an important BDS activist. Chris Denhant, Paris.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
Decades of segregation and economic inequality in the U.S. shoehorned many people of color, especially Black Americans, into living in neighborhoods that are more vulnerable to climate change, says Jessica Corbett, writer, in an article titled, Study Finds U.S. Redlined Areas Face Greater Flood Risk from Climate Crisis. Stay tuned for more. Amid inadequate plans to reduce planet-heating emissions and climate scientists' repeated warnings about rising seas and more devastating extreme weather, Redfin revealed recently that formerly redlined areas across the United States face a higher flood risk than regions that weren't deemed undesirable for mortgage lending under the racist practice. The real estate brokerage analyzed flood risk in 38 major U.S. metropolitan areas for a new report entitled a racist past, a flooded future. Formerly redlined areas have $107 billion worth of homes facing high flood risk, 25% more than non-redlined areas. In 1930s, the federally sponsored Homeowners Loan Corporation developed mortgage security maps that ranked communities with grades and colors, from A, the best for lenders, in green, to B, still desirable, in blue, to C, definitely declining, in yellow, to D zones declared hazardous, in red. While racial segregation of neighborhoods predated redlining, the lowest-ranked areas generally had more black families, while white households dominated regions with higher ratings. Though the Fair Housing Act of 1968 legally banned racial discrimination in housing, many neighborhoods once marked hazardous are still home to many people of color and low-income families. According to Redfin, 58.1% of households in redlined neighborhoods are non-white, compared with 40.4% of households in neighborhoods once declared desirable for lending. Decades of segregation and economic inequality shoehorned many people of color, especially black Americans, into living in neighborhoods that are more vulnerable to climate change, said Redfin senior economist Sheriar Bukhari. Redlining kept home values in black neighborhoods depressed, which in turn meant there was less money invested and reinvested in those neighborhoods for decades to come. The cycle continues today, Bukhari said. As climate change fuels rising sea levels and powerful storms, many of these neighborhoods lack the funding for the infrastructure upgrades necessary to combat flooding. When major storms hit, black communities are often forced to spend years rebuilding their homes instead of moving on and building home equity, the economist continued. This perpetuates a cycle in which black families lack financially. From Hurricane Katrina in 2005 to Hurricane Harvey in 2017, communities of color and poor residents were disproportionately affected long-term. Last year saw a record-breaking Atlantic hurricane season, and experts warn that human-caused climate change is expected to exacerbate the impact of future storms. Severe storms and hurricanes have a disproportionate effect on minorities in terms of damage done, life lost, and the amount of money that gets reimbursed, Bukhari told Bloomberg. He added, this project was done to look back at the legacy of redlining and link it to the outcomes we see today. As Redfin found, nationally redlined and yellow-lined neighborhoods have a larger share of homes with high flood risk than green-lined and blue-lined neighborhoods, but only by a small margin, that is about 8.4% versus 6.9%. The discrepancy is much larger in a handful of U.S. metros, including Sacramento, New York, Boston, and Chicago. In Sacramento, 21.6% of homes, that is about $2.6 billion worth, in redlined and yellow-lined areas face high risk of flooding today. That compares with 11.8% of homes, that is about $716.8 million worth, in green-lined and blue-lined neighborhoods. That 9.8 percentage point difference represents the biggest gap of any metro in this analysis that had a large share of homes at risk in red-lined and yellow-lined neighborhoods. Nearly half of the households in Sacramento's red-lined and yellow-lined areas are occupied by people of color, compared with a third of households in green-lined and blue-lined areas. Behind the California capital is New York, where 13.8% of homes in red-lined and yellow-lined neighborhoods are at high risk of flooding, compared with 7.1% of homes in green-lined and blue-lined neighborhoods. The next two metro areas with the greatest gaps were Boston, 13.8% to 8.7%, then Chicago, 12.6% to 7.9%. The discrimination that happened in the past may seem like it happened a long time ago, but it compounds. Redfin chief economist Daryl Fairweather told CNN Business, "It's not like the historical practices that were discriminatory diminished in effect. It seems like they actually increase in effect." Noting that over 600,000 properties face a 100-year flood risk, which is risk of one of these really catastrophic floods hitting them, Fairweather warned that future flood damage could worsen the U.S. racial wealth gap. In the face of rising seas and expected storm damage, Redfin and others have recommended federal investment in weather-proofing homes and relocation assistance. Fairweather said that when we do provide assistance for people to move, we should encourage them or insist they move into places that won't be as affected by climate change. Research published in 2019 suggested that banks are already shifting mortgages made riskier by the climate crisis to financial institutions backed by U.S. taxpayers. Findings that, as New York Times put it, echo the subprime lending crisis of 2008, when unexpected drops in home values cascaded through the economy and triggered recession. With lenders looking at long-term risks and some U.S. communities from the coast to heartland already dealing with floods, President Biden is under pressure from climate experts and campaigners who backed his campaign to deliver on his promise to implement bold policies advancing environmental justice.
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. In a forum held here in Tehran, Iran's top diplomat Mohammad Javad Zarif criticized extra-regional powers as a source of instability in this region. He took a jab at the U.S., whose military presence he believes has brought insecurity to West Asia. The Syrian foreign minister also criticized the U.S. for occupying Syrian soil and backing terrorists fighting the Damascus government. American officials have admitted having wasted $7 trillion in this region. Now, in tonight's debate show, we'll review the U.S. military intervention in the region since two decades ago in such countries as Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Sudan, and Libya.
The fundamental question, though, is...
Iran's foreign minister says interventions by outside powers, especially by the U.S., are the main cause of instability in the West Asia region. Mohammad Javad Zarif made the comment during the second Tehran Dialogue Forum. During his address, Zarif also talked about the reshaping of the region, but noted that such a move requires the identification of principal causes of the problems.
The U.S. has exacerbated the insecurity and instability of this region more than any other region. As its own figures suggest, some $7 trillion have been wasted on forever wars and military interventions in this region.
The top Iranian diplomat underlined that the U.S. interventions are aimed at dominating the region. He said the region has turned into a military zone for the U.S. and its allies through their troop presence and arms sales to certain states. Addressing the Tehran Dialogue Forum, Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad highlighted the U.S. occupation of his country. He said that Washington formed a coalition under the pretext of fighting terrorism, but its main agenda was to attack Syria and threaten other regional countries.
The United States and the European Union, or the leading countries in the European Union, are using this coalition to attack Syria, to threaten other independent countries in the region, and to claim that they are fighting against Daesh. Daesh, in fact, has been encouraged and supported by the United States.
Years of devastation in Syria caused by the U.S. and its allies with their backing to terror groups are just the tip of the iceberg. U.S. interventionist agenda in other countries such as Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, and Libya all show that Washington wants to destabilize West Asia to dominate it. However, such stance has simply ignited anti-U.S. sentiment across many countries. In Iraq, protests against the presence of American troops and a parliamentary resolution for the expulsion of all U.S. troops last year are part of the sentiment. Calls grew louder after the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in a drone attack in January last year. The U.S. too has come to a conclusion that its West Asia policies have been a complete failure. Last week, the U.S. government, for the first time, acknowledged that the Yemen war has no military solution. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken also told UN Special Envoy for Yemen, Martin Griffiths, that diplomatic efforts should be redoubled with the help of the UN and other players to end the Yemen war. But shouldn't Washington be blamed for the Yemen carnage, as it's been the main supplier of arms to Saudi Arabia and its allies that invaded the impoverished nation? But the U.S. views the West Asia region as a military zone, and what matters to Washington most is making profit out of chaos and conflicts, for it can sell more weapons to the rich Arab states.
Now let me now introduce our guests in this debate show tonight. We'll have executive from the Executive Intelligence Review, we have Bill Jones in Leesburg, and also editor of the Veterans Today, Mike Harris in Phoenix. Good to have you both gentlemen on the show. Now let me start by going to Leesburg to Bill Jones. Bill, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says that interventions by the U.S. are the main cause of instability in the West Asia region. What do you think is the underlying reason for Washington's interference in this part of the world, which certainly began after the Second World War?
Well, basically, it's been the fact that since the death of Franklin Roosevelt,
well, unfortunately, we have a little technical glitch with Leesburg. Let me go to Phoenix. And ask Mike Harris. Mike, West Asia has become a military zone for the U.S. and its allies through their troop presence and arms sales to certain states. Afghanistan, Iraq, Yemen, Syria, Sudan, and Libya are among a long list of military interventions. Why does the U.S. insist on destabilizing this region? Is it because of the oil or because of Israel's security?
No, I think it's because the U.S. Foreign policy has been captured by the interest of Israel. You have to remember that the U.S. Has a very powerful Israeli lobby, and that they influence U.S. political positions, both domestically and foreign. There is no upside for the U.S. as a nation to go in and participate militarily in the destruction of the Middle East. This is purely to fortify Israel's position and to buy them a false sense of security. Really, this needs to be done and demonstrated. Under the direction of former President Trump, we saw a great deal of downsizing and withdrawal from both Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan, and that has been immediately reversed under the Biden administration. And so although Donald Trump was very friendly and pro-Israel on a number of fronts and areas. He was also very pro-America to get America from wasting its resources and fighting these endless wars. Under the previous administration before Trump, under Obama, you had the U.S. actually funding terrorist activities. I was in Syria during 2014, 15, and again in 16, and I actually saw captured U.S. munitions, TOW missiles that are made by Raytheon Corporation in Tucson, Arizona, that had been captured by the Syrian Arab Army, and recorded the serial numbers on these things, referred them to Department of State and a number of other things. So, U.S. resources that were being given to Syria, the good terrorists, the pro-American rebels, if you will, mm-hmm. were actually being diverted and given to Daesh and to ISIS themselves.
Okay.
So the U.S. foreign policy over there, again, has been captured by the Israelis.
Yeah. And we'll go to countries one by one. Okay. Now, let's go to Leesburg. Hopefully that sound problem with Leesburg is solved. Bill Jones, you were talking about the underlying reason for Washington's interference in this region.
Well, primarily since the end of the Second World War, there was an attempt by the British Empire, especially after the death of Franklin Roosevelt. And remember, Roosevelt was the first one to be involved in the Middle East when he met with Abdulaziz in Saudi Arabia during the war. But Roosevelt's idea was to go back to the region after the war and to irrigate the desert. He died. Truman came in. Truman became a puppet of Winston Churchill, and the United States began to adopt the role that the British Empire had had in the previous century to be the policeman of the world. That role was contested by President Trump, as the former speaker said, but there was a general agreement within the political establishment, heavily influenced by this British ideology, that the United States must remain the number one power in the world. That is now specifically named as U.S. policy. And in doing that, it has to intervene in all these areas, not because of what's happening so much in the region itself. As we see in Syria, as we see in Iraq, the United States is also there to counter Russian influence. In the case of Iraq, to counter Chinese influence. And the big game is really between the major powers, that the United States is not prepared to accept another major power with which it can work, with which it can reconcile and operate together with, and so that they're conducting operations, some of which are surrogate warfare involving other peoples, but is directly aimed at countering one of the other major powers. And this has been the case in the Middle East for some time. And we look at the U.S., what the foreign minister said was on the mark, that everybody knows that when the U.S. went into Iraq, this was the real beginning of the troubles in the Middle East, which had previously been problematic, but not so violent. After that, it became hell on earth.
Okay. Now, Mike, you were talking about Syria, and we had the Syrian foreign minister, Mr. Faisal Miqdad, telling the Tehran Dialogue Forum here today that Washington formed a coalition under the pretext of fighting terrorism, but its main agenda was to attack Syria and also threaten other regional countries. Let's have your take on that.
Well, that's definitely correct. And trying to remember who the general was who stated about a decade or so ago that the U.S. had plans to topple seven countries in the Middle East, and Syria was on that list. Mm-hmm. And so that hasn't changed. Well, the problem we have is that the U.S. foreign policy is not directed by the officials who are elected. U.S. foreign policy has got an established State Department cadre in there that hasn't changed or turned over in decades. And they're conducting their own foreign policy against the wishes of the American people. This was demonstrated very clearly by the election of Donald Trump and the changes that he tried to make by withdrawing U.S. forces out of the Middle East and was thwarted nearly at every turn. So it just shows that the deep state is at work in the State Department as well as the DOJ and other corrupted organizations in the U.S. government. And you have to realize that the U.S. government is functioning currently as a captured operation by foreign powers. And so Israel comes to mind, and uh, as uh, Mr. Jones, I think, from EIR stated, under British influence as well. And so the U.S. has to reevaluate its position and put our elected form of government back into the power of the true republic and stop this deep state manipulation of what we're doing. Because most Americans have no issue, they have no desire to embrace the globalist agenda. And so they wish to break free of that and function as a truly sovereign nation again. But the foreign minister of Iran was correct in his statement that U.S. is meddling in Syria. And I spoke with some people who are friendly with me from the Russian foreign ministry, and their view on this is that the road to Moscow goes through first Damascus, then Tehran, then into Moscow. And so the Russians have a very solid interest in protecting their southern flank. And so they're going to oppose anyone who tries to use the terrorism as a surrogate war-fighting mechanism in order to bring chaos and regime change to that region.
Okay, now, Bill, let's take a look at Afghanistan now. Close to two decades passed since American forces decided their military intervention there to restore, as they call it, peace. Still, violence is claiming innocent civilian lives, and insecurity is rampant. How do you evaluate the U.S. presence in Afghanistan?
It's extremely problematic, and it has been from the get-go. There may have been a reason going in there directly after 9/11, but staying there now for how many, 14, 15 years, is a no-win situation. You don't want chaos in Afghanistan, but you can't prevent chaos by simply having American troops there. The solution would have to be that the United States would have to get together not only with the Afghanis, but also with the countries in the region who border Afghanistan, that is including India, including China, to try and bring to bear the influence that these different countries have on that situation to create some form of economic development. But the U.S. refuses to do that by and large because it feels that it has to be the policeman of the world and therefore has to take the point on this. It's what, like I said, what the British used to do in Afghanistan. They had the same role in Afghanistan in the 19th century, and they dealt with the same problems. If the U.S. would go back to its own tradition, if it would go back to the tradition of an independent republic and not as a imperial enforcer, it would be able to deal with these situations diplomatically by bringing in other countries with influence and not trying to do everything themselves by shedding the blood and the treasure of the American people. We really had a glimpse of that during the Trump administration, although he seemed to be overwhelmed by the neocons that he unfortunately brought with him. But that's really where the American people are. But as your other speaker said, the political establishment is heavily influenced by what's called the Anglo-American relationship. And that relationship is such that the British see themselves as the brain and the United States as the brawn. Mm-hmm. If we break with that and again use our own brains to develop our own policy instead of following in the old imperial way, we'd probably be able to deal with the problems of the world much more effectively.
Mm-hmm. Mike, Washington also invaded Iraq and removed its ally, the Iraqi strongman Saddam Hussein, on unfounded claims of presence of weapons of mass destruction in that country. Now, to spend big bucks, as you know, setting up the big, beautiful military bases in Iraq, as Mr. Trump put it, and now Iraqi parliamentarians want American forces out, but they're turning a deaf ear. Tell us about the repercussions of U.S. intervention in Iraq.
Well, the repercussions of U.S. intervention in Iraq is they destabilize the entire region. That's the major repercussion. The U.S. government lies about virtually everything to the American people and to the rest of the world. They try to create the fraud of, weapons of mass destruction to justify going in there after they allege that Saddam Hussein somehow had participated in 9/11, which is another fraud upon the American people and the world. The real perpetrators of 9/11 are still walking around out there and have never been brought to justice. No one believes that 19 Arabs with box cutters actually brought down the Twin Towers. So, you know, we've got some fundamental flaws, and we're essentially, the U.S. is being run by a bunch of gangsters right now. We have been for a very long time. And they have, as I said, captured the operations of our government. Mm-hmm. And it's time for the American people to stand up and demand change on this, because we can't go on doing criminal activities around the world. If you look at the example of Afghanistan, the opium traffic was the lowest under the Taliban, and it's the highest under the U.S. occupation.
Exactly.
The reason the U.S. is still there, 19 going on 20 years later, is because the opium profits are so outstanding and so great that they fund all the black programs that the CIA and the deep state want to fund anything in the world that they want to do. They have the funds to do it. And so they're never going to leave Afghanistan until we, the people of the United States, drag them out of their positions of power and reform our own government from within. And, the fact that the Democrat cheating in this last election has gone unchallenged is just, offensive to most of us Americans here. But we really need to get back. Who runs this country? Are we truly a democratic republic where the people's vote counts and we have a voice in our government? Or have we been hijacked and are we being run by this deep state criminal gangster operation?
Right.
That's the question that the people of the United States have to ask, and that's the question that the other governments of the world have to ask when dealing with the United States.
Yeah, good
because
question.
It is very obvious to all of us who live here that we are no longer a Democrat Republic, and we've got to take that back. We have to take that to them. And all of these other problems, whether in the Middle East or everywhere else in the world, they will resolve themselves.
Okay, I'm sorry, we're running out of time. So I have one more question for Bill. Another country in the region is Yemen, which has been under the U.S. drone strikes and a U.S.-backed Saudi-led war for 6 years. Rights groups have complained about the use of American-made weaponry and ammunition in the impoverished country. Yet it doesn't seem that the U.S. would have stopped the lucrative sale of weapons to Saudi child killers. Is Washington not an accomplice to crimes committed in Yemen?
Absolutely the case. There has been, one could call it genocide against the Yemeni population, to the extent that food supplies for many of the people who are homeless there have been restricted by the Saudi operations, and that the U.S. has been playing softball with the Saudis. Even the latest case of the Khashoggi murder, which the Biden administration released the report on the fact that the number two man and maybe the number one man in Saudi Arabia was responsible for that, but they didn't hold him responsible because the Saudi relationship, the oil relationship, and the political relationship seems to be a number one importance to the U.S. in maintaining hegemony in the region. And the weapon sale, of course, to the Saudis is a part of using them in this game, and letting them run free when necessary and trying to keep them under control otherwise. But it's been a mess, and Yemen is a tragedy, and I think it's, to call it a genocide is directly on the mark, and there should be war crimes trials for that.
Okay, on that note, we come to the end of this debate. Thank you, my guests from the Executive Intelligence Review. We had Bill Jones in Leesburg, and also editor of the Veterans Today, Mike Harris, who joined us out of Phoenix with a comments and contribution.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
The United States has been criticized for purchasing 200 million more COVID-19 vaccines for its own citizens and pushing poorer countries and vulnerable populations to the back of the queue, while experts estimate that the low-income countries will experience wide access after 2022. We present you an article written by Azad Issa. The piece is titled "Experts Warn of Protracted Pandemic Amid Vaccine Apartheid." The article has been taken from the MiddleEastEye.net website. Please stay with us for more of Azad Issa's article. Global inequality campaigners and health experts have warned of protracted public health crises in several North African and West Asian countries amid the monopoly of COVID-19 vaccine by wealthy nations. Noting that rich nations were racing ahead of poorer ones to immunize their citizens, Amjad El-Khouli, an epidemiologist at the World Health Organization WHO's regional office for the Eastern Mediterranean region, said, "We're seeing an unequal distribution of COVID-19 vaccine around the world." Citing World Health Organization data, Middle East Eye said only 14 out of 21 countries in the Eastern Mediterranean region, which extends from Morocco to Afghanistan, have received inoculations, equivalent to little more than 1% of the population of the entire region. Amjad El-Khouli said, "This has never been more critical than in our region, where health workers are a rare and valuable resource, and vulnerable people should be the first to receive support rather than be left behind." His remarks came just days after World Health Organization expert Mark Ryan said 80% of all global vaccines had been administered in just 10 wealthy countries. The starkest illustrations of vaccine inequality were evident in West Asia, where countries such as Qatar, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates were inoculating nationals and foreign workers at a frenetic pace, while countries like Yemen were lagging behind. The report also referred to the situation in the occupied Palestine, where about 60% of Israelis have received jabs, whilst Palestinians living under occupation have been told they could have to wait for many months before they're vaccinated. Activists say it is systematic dereliction of political leadership at the highest level that is triggering this threat to global public health. Anna Marriott, health policy advisor for the charity Oxfam, says, "It is vaccine apartheid." She adds, "There is no other way of describing it." Anna Marriott says, "If you think of the promises that were made at the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic, that the vaccine would be a global public good, our leaders have failed. In an attempt to seek a more equitable access to the COVID-19 vaccine, the World Health Organization, WHO, and the Gavi Vaccine Alliance are leading a facility called COVAX to deliver doses of approved vaccines fairly around the world. However, global campaigners say donations alone are not going to cut it. The United States has been criticized for purchasing 200 million more vaccines for its own citizens and pushing poorer countries and vulnerable populations to the back of the queue. While experts estimate the low-income countries will experience wide access to the vaccine only after 2022. El-Khoury says, "We understand that every government and leadership worldwide are keen on vaccinating their own populations. However, we reiterate that wider is wiser, meaning that introducing the vaccine to the priority categories in all countries is much better than vaccinating all people in a few countries." Experts warn that delaying inoculations will allow the virus opportunity to mutate, potentially undermining available vaccines and ultimately global recovery. El-Khoury says, "The global economy cannot recover if there are disparities in global vaccine coverage. Not only will vaccines help save lives and stabilize health systems, but they can help to drive a global economic recovery. That recovery cannot take place if half of the world is hamstrung from the economic fallout of COVID-19." U.S. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar has said that Washington should be instead ensuring the broadest possible distribution of the coronavirus vaccine. Ilhan Omar says letting people in the global south wait years for the vaccine is a policy choice, and they don't have to make it. Until everyone is safe from the virus, no one is. The United States has also been slammed for undermining the attempt to accelerate the vaccine rollout elsewhere. According to the report, the United States and other Western countries are opposing calls for temporarily waiving the World Trade Organization's trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights for those technologies needed to address the coronavirus pandemic. The proposal was put forward by South Africa and India and endorsed by 100 other countries. Anna Maria from the charity Oxfam says, "There are solutions on the table which rich countries are standing in the way of. They need to support the TRIPS intellectual property waiver from developing countries, and unlocking the supply of the vaccine is the only route to redressing this apartheid situation. The hoarding of medical supplies is neither novel nor unique to the coronavirus vaccine. In 2009, the World Health Organization had a grapple with the greed of wealthy nations buying up the H1N1 vaccine that inevitably tied up global supply and left the rest of the world without access to the vaccine. Prior to the H1N1, there was the HIV/AIDS pandemic." Fatima Hassan, a social justice activist and human rights lawyer, says, "Today's situation is eerily similar to the HIV/AIDS epidemic and crisis of access in the late 1990s and early 2000s, when the diagnostic and therapeutic tools to save millions of lives were there, but the will to share them was not." Fatima Hassan says, "Without the temporary TRIPS waiver now, countries will be required to take individual domestic action and legal measures whilst managing a pandemic." Sharifa Sakalala, an associate professor at the School of Law at the University of Warwick in England, says, "The problem goes far beyond the question of intellectual property rights." Sharifa Sakalala says, "Human rights have largely been ignored in arguments about vaccine rollouts and substituted for arguments of equity. This feels like a missed opportunity to really think about the vaccine as something that is fundamental to the right of life, to the right to health, but also access to wider social and economic rights, given that ordinary life has been so constrained by this coronavirus pandemic. The pandemic has taken its heavy toll in Yemen as well. Yemen is currently grappling with a Saudi military aggression. Nahla Arishi, a Yemeni pediatrician, says COVID-19 shook countries with advanced healthcare systems and services. What will it do to a country like Yemen that has lived in the shadow of war for the past 5 years? According to the Middle East Eye, no more than half of Yemen's medical facilities are currently functioning. Middle East Eye also cited reports issued last year as saying that there were fewer than 10 medics for every 10,000 Yemenis. Anna Marriott from the charity Oxfam says, "We know that over 53% of the population in Yemen is in need of humanitarian assistance. 16.2 million Yemenis rely on food aid to survive. So the crisis was already immense and completely unacceptable even before the COVID-19 pandemic." She adds, "Unless we get vaccines to people, that suffering is going to escalate every day." Recently, United Nations Chief Antonio Guterres blasted what he called many examples of vaccine nationalism and hoarding of vaccines during the pandemic. Antonio Guterres said in a statement that wealthier countries are far outpacing poorer nations in vaccinating their populations, and called on coronavirus vaccines to be seen as a global public good. The United Nations Chief Guterres said the global vaccination campaign represents the greatest moral test of our times, and he criticized side deals with COVID-19 vaccine manufacturers that undermine access to all people in the world. Antonio Guterres said, "Ensuring that all the peoples of the world are vaccinated and many low-income countries have not yet received a single dose of the vaccine is essential to restart the global economy and help the world move from locking down societies to locking down the virus." He added, "The world needs to unite to produce and distribute sufficient vaccines for all, which means at least doubling manufacturing capacity of the vaccine around the world." Antonio Guterres added, "That effort must start now." According to data from Johns Hopkins University, some 117 million people are confirmed to have been infected by the coronavirus, and more than 2.6 million people have already lost their lives.